You can argue that if there's one band that's been significant and enduring over the last 30 plus years, it would be Ireland's U2. Their story, their music, and their message has vaulted them to this place, making them one of the most beloved rock and roll bands of all time. What is it about U2 that makes them so provocative and compelling? And how has the Christian faith played into the ethos of the band? And how should we be interpreting and processing the band's music? Belfast native, pastor, and music critic Steve Stockman has written about U2 in his book, Walk On. Stay with us for a fascinating conversation with Steve about U2 on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Youth Culture Matters, and this will be a fun one because I'm joined, as always, or as usual, by Jason Sochnick, who's in Spokane, Washington. Jason, welcome.
It's good to be here. I'm excited for this one.
Yeah, so let's just a little of the backstory on this one. So we were getting ready to record the last podcast, and before we actually hit record, you and I were looking at talking with Preston Sprinkle,
yes,
who was on a podcast that we put out a while ago, and I had mentioned to Preston that with his beanie on and his scruff, he looked quite a bit like The Edge from U2.
Most definitely.
Yeah, and he got excited about that because he's a big U2 fan. Then you got excited about it because you're a big U2 fan. Then I started to chime in because Lisa and I have been to U2 concerts. She's a big U2 fan. And then you held up this book from...
Yeah.
And it's not a brand new book. It's a book that was written back, according to the copyright here, 2001, called Walk On, The Spiritual Journey of U2 by Steve Stockman. And I said, hey, you know what? I've read that book, and I know Steve Stockman. I've been over to Belfast, and I met Steve there, and I've had an interview or two with him, and Steve and I have corresponded back and forth over the years. So we said, let's get Steve on a podcast. And then what did you
do? Well, I screamed like a little girl because I was like, are you kidding me? I love this book. This is
It's a great
book.
This
is up there with many of my favorite books because it talks about one of my favorite artists, and it was my first concert I ever went to, which then made it on to what was Rattle and Hum. So, you know, I feel like I don't know if I can ever top my first concert experience.
Yeah, yeah. So we said, let's get Steve on. And then we started to talk through this. Steve said, yeah, I'll come on. And I said, you know what we got to do next? We got to get Mike Flamin on because he's like.
Oh, yeah.
It would be unfair to say he's the world's oldest U2 fan. Is that unfair, Mike?
I'll accept that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a badge of honor, and it doesn't. But you might be one of the world's longest running U2 fans, right?
I think so, man. The first time I saw them, 1985, in the San Francisco Cow Palace, and Bono came out and said, "Tonight, we're going to turn this cow shed into a palace," and he did. I was just stunned.
Yeah. So and Mike, you've been to how many U2 concerts?
Probably 20. I've spent a few bucks on it.
Yeah. You have. And then Lisa and I actually got to go last June, right? We went to the Link in Philadelphia, and we saw the U2. Yeah, I was part of the tour last year. So yeah, it was great. So the key cog in all this right now is Steve Stockman, and Steve's in Belfast. Steve, welcome.
Good to be with you. Isn't it the wonders of Skype? Here I am speaking to as far west as Washington. That's exciting.
Yeah, now I'm going to let you in on a little secret here, and it works like this, Steve. When we're from the U.S., the way we talk, because I got to talk about your accent real quick. The basic rule is, you can say anything you want in this podcast, and because of your accent, it's going to sound brilliant, and everyone's going to hang on to every word. So I'm going to ask you to rise above that and share some wisdom with us on YouTube. Don't rely on your accent, because we could be easily snowed here. But Steve, thanks for coming in. I've known Steve for, man, it's probably close
a long
to
time.
Yeah, 20 years now since we first met over there at Queens University. Yeah. Was that where it was? And but Steve, tell everybody a little bit about who you are and what you do, and then we'll get into, you know, your book and what motivated you to write that. We'll talk about the content of that. We'll talk about the band, but a little bit about you first so people get to know you.
Yeah, I'm a Presbyterian minister. When you were over, Walt, I was the chaplain at Queen's University, and I'm still around Queen's University, but I'm now the minister of Fitzroy Presbyterian Church. And I suppose I've got a new name that I think you Americans conjured up, which is a theomusicologist, which is someone who is taking music like that of U2 and trying to find the theology and the threads of the theology in and around U2. And I've been doing that since I was 20, 21 years of age, going into youth missions, trying to find some phrase that might catch the attention of a couple of hundred teenagers who didn't want to listen to me, and trying to draw out, I suppose as Paul did in Athens, trying to pull out what the poets of the day were saying to try and draw them to Jesus. I came to faith when I was 17. The Beatles were asking all the questions for me, but Jesus was giving me more answers than the rock musicians. And not long after that, Bob Dylan came to faith, and I discovered this band from the same island as I'm on called U2. And we came to faith around the same time. I bought October when it came out, and I put on Gloria. Can remember the needle sitting down on the vinyl and thinking, that expresses my faith. And I think they've been doing that ever since. They've gone through a journey of faith like I have. We're the same age, we're from the same island. And it's been a great journey to try and work out the theology of their music as I've gone along.
Now, go back real quick to what you said about Paul in Athens. And that really is what drives us here in terms of methodology and looking at culture. And I think one of your buddies over there across the ocean, if I'm not mistaken, Steve Turner, is he a friend of yours?
Yes, I know Steve. Yeah. In fact, I think I probably sold a few books because people thought Steve Turner had written a book on U2. So I'm very thankful to Steve.
Yeah, we had him on last year to talk about Beatles 66.
Oh, what a book!
Oh yeah, it's great. And we've also pushed his book Pop Cultured, which, going back to what I just asked you about in terms of Paul in Athens, you know, Steve really works that out as well. Just make mention, you know, for people who might not be familiar with how that works in terms of taking the posture of Paul in Athens, you know, that desire to know the culture and then contextualize, how that works out in the world of popular music.
I think I was doing it for maybe 5 years because, as I said before, I was at the time I was the youth speaker of the youth missions, and I was being put on stages in front of young people who didn't have much time for the church or Jesus or listening to me. And so what I did accidentally, probably in hindsight, was to try and pull out a line. We're talking the mid-80s. It was probably Bruce Springsteen or U2. And try to get them thinking, oh, he just mentioned my favorite singer, I'm going to listen to him. It wasn't until after that I started to read Steve Turner and discovered someone who had theologized, or at least tried to work through the argument of why I did it. And in the middle of all of that, I obviously was drawn to Acts chapter 17, where Paul, who's been preaching in synagogues up until now, using the symbols and references that would have resonated with a Jewish audience, found himself in a place where, the blood of the lamb or sacrificial things or all the words and all the Old Testament phrases that caught the imagination of a Jewish audience were not working with a Greek audience. And so he had to work out what are the connectors in the culture around me. And it tells us in Acts chapter 17, he looked at all the idols, he read all the poets and the philosophers, And he came with their arguments, and he brought Jesus into that conversation and that argument. And I think we should be doing that with everything. We're a church here in Fitzroy who contextualizes the scriptures in the context of a divided society, who contextualizes the scriptures in a post-Brexit Ireland, who contextualizes the scriptures with all that's going on around Syria. And so pop culture is one of those things. Sunday night we did the gospel, the Dylan gospel years. So I had some of my congregation singing 10 of the songs off Dylan's gospel albums. And I call myself a preach jockey. I don't disc jockey my way through the songs. I bring a theological thought between the songs.
And this is all what you're talking about here. This is all, you know, we have a lot of youth workers and a lot of parents who listen in. This is all part of what we're called to as parents and youth workers as we, you know, communicate the truth.
I'm not a youth worker and I'm a parent, and that's much more scary because all the things I thought I had skills in, I remember telling my wife, oh, leave the teens to me, I'm an expert in that. And that didn't prove very good when my children became teens. But the best thing about our engaging with culture the way we did with the Bob Dylan night and the way we've done with the U2 nights, we've done the Songs of Experience, Songs of Innocence, we did the Songs of Innocence tour, and we did the songs they did off that tour, and I came out with theological stuff between it. The best thing for me now is that I'll be driving along in the car with my daughters, and they'll say to me, Dad, you see that Lady Gaga song? You could use that in a gospel according to. And I'll say, well, why? And they'll say, well, if you listen carefully to what she's singing there, she's talking about unconditional love and the need for unconditional love. And Jesus gives us that, doesn't he, Daddy? And I'm suddenly thinking it's teaching people how to read the culture that they're imbibing anyway. We're listening to a lot of music. We're watching a lot of television. We're hearing all these symbols that are around us. And so one of the things we have to do is as Christians bring that Christian mind to bear on what is the culture saying, and how does, my phrase is, how does that caress and collide with the gospel and with our Christian lives? And I suppose the U2 book came out of that. Mm.
So now I'm going to hand a baton to Jason because he's giddy. He's really giddy about this, and he gets to talk to you. You know, because you wrote the book. He was excited about the book. The book is in his pillowcase. I mean, it's – go ahead, Jason.
Wow. Well, you know, I just love that you use the words preach jockey. that is going to be a phrase that is stolen, because that is absolutely the best phrase that we've had on a podcast in a long time. I absolutely love that. I think that where I'd love to just start with the book is how it even came into light, like how it came to be, because I love how you were talking about how you were coming to faith around the time that it sounds like U2 was coming to faith and then releasing some of their work. So before you even get to the book, what was that?
Jason, I can't hear Jason at the minute.
Okay.
I got the first bit of that, but then he sadly disappeared.
Wasn't meant to be, Jason.
It's happened a couple of times. Jason seems to fade out now and again, whereas the rest of you seem very clear. I'm not sure why.
It's possible you're nodding off, because this happens to me every now and then when he's talking. Go ahead, Jason.
It's not because
go ahead
not
and say
off.
What you said.
Yeah. The thing that I'm most curious about is how what it was like prior to writing the book, because you said you came to faith right around the time that U2 was coming on the scene. Yeah. So talk a little bit more about that journey, and then talk about how that then led to you utilizing their music to speak to teens on a Sunday night.
Yeah, well, when I said that in the early and mid-80s I was using rock stars and musicians to engage with culture, U2 were a very different thing, because you would have been listening to maybe Promised Land by Bruce Springsteen, and you would be using it as a kind of a doorway into talking about something that really wasn't the theology of Springsteen's song. When it came to U2, they became, wow, these guys are the best band in the world, and they're singing theology. So if you take, you know, You Broke the Bonds, Loosed the Chains, Carried the Cross, and My Shame, you know, I Believe It, That was number one in the USA for 4 weeks. That Theology was at the top of the American charts for 4 weeks. When Amy Grant got to the top of the charts, she was singing Baby Baby. You know, this was amazing that that we had this theology already in the songs. So I didn't have to use them as gimmicks to contrive a message. I was then able, I mean, I remember using, I still haven't found what I'm looking for, to talk about justification and sanctification. And I was doing that because I was in a youth group where the leaders were around the door a little bit suspicious that I was using U2. So I said, you know, that's a little bit like sanctification. And those guys were gripped. And so I was using U2 for a long time. And the thing that frustrated me most was that people were telling me they weren't Christians. And here is the truth, Jason. And it's quite a story. On a Thursday evening, I think, I got an email. Because I had a web page quite early on, and but now we're talking about obviously around 2000. I got an email from somebody who was angrily arguing with my some web article I'd put on, and he was saying they weren't Christians, and if they are Christians, they're embarrassed about their faith. And we went away for the weekend with my family, and I said to my wife, somebody has to write a book that explains to these people and teaches these people the theology of U2. And it was the first time I'd come up with a book idea that my wife Janice didn't say, don't be silly, love, go and listen to Unforgettable Fire. So what I did was I jotted down a few chapter headings. I need to say that the same Thursday, within about 2 hours of that email, I got another email from a guy in Florida who I'd never heard of, who said, Steve, we're Relevant Communications. What is on your heart? Oh, what do you mean? So I sent him back an email saying, what do you mean what's on my heart? I looked up at the webpage and I heard they were wanting to write books. And I said, are you asking me if I have any idea for books? This was Thursday. So I went away for the weekend, angry at the other guy's email. I put together a few chapters of a book on U2. I came back on Sunday night and I'd got a reply from Florida saying, yes, we are thinking about a book. Have you ever thought of writing a book on U2? I sent him what I jotted down at the weekend and he sent me a contract. And we started to do what I would have said was, in the essence, almost an apologetic for U2. It was almost trying to say, have you listened to this song? Have you read the Bible? Are you able to connect this song with the Bible? And I therefore, now at that point, I went away for about a week and I wrote 35,000 words in a week because I had 20 years of preparation done that I didn't know about. So I was just able to go up there and rattle off chapter after chapter on Sunday Bloody Sunday and Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For and Joshua Tree and Live Aid. And then we got pretty blessed. That's the Christian term for it. Lucky would be a term in the real world, where U2 became the biggest band on the planet again as we were writing the book. And so when the book came out, nobody else had thought of writing a book about U2 because they'd kind of fallen off a little bit after Pop Mart. But by the end of the Elevation tour, they were the biggest band in the world again. We were the only book out. And so everybody that pressed U2 into Amazon got what on the spiritual journey of U2, and that was a blessing. So at the end of the writing of the book, we actually had to change. We realized that suddenly we had a wider audience, and it wasn't going to be just an apologetic for the church, but this was going to be a book that might be in mainstream shops, and it was going to be a book that we were going to be able to articulate some really good Christian theology into the mainstream, as indeed U2 were doing.
Wow. Yeah. Well, okay, I have a follow-up, but we need to take a break.
Well, before we do that, can I ask a question? Because I want Mike to chime in here before we break, because exactly what Steve has been doing, you know, as a preach jockey.
Yes.
I mean, Mike, you've been doing that as well with U2, right? I mean, just mention something about that, because we were talking about what you wrote, what you and your son Andrew wrote. Correct.
Yeah, Steve. Hey, first I want to tell you, Steve, I loved your book, man. Reading that through put framework on things I've been thinking, but really couldn't frame up for myself. And first time I ever saw U2 in 85. It was one of those moments. I mean, this sounds extreme, but it really changed my life, like in so many ways, and just put into a much more clear cultural context the gospel. And your book helped me frame that out so much better. But yeah, we wrote my son, and the first guy I ever went to see U2 with, he was 15 back in 1985. He and I are still close. The three of us wrote a 3-week devotional guide using U2 lyrics from Joshua Tree and scripture passages from the desert, because we take groups down into the Mexican desert to build homes. And it was just great, you know, because like you mentioned in your book that Joshua Tree is a perfect album. And I agree, you know, and so, yeah, we use that for a devotional guide. Mm.
Yeah. And we're going to try to link up to that. We're working through some of the details of that, but for those who are listening, we're going to try to link up to that. Go ahead, Jason. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I've got a specific question that I want to come back to before, but because we need to go to break, we'll come back to it. But I, Steve, when we come back from break, this is the question for you. I want to know what your favorite chapter was to write, because there's so many great chapters, and they're all based upon albums and songs. But I'm really curious, as you stepped away for that week, which one was the most challenging, and maybe it was also the one that was the most fun to write, or maybe the one that was most fun and the one that was most challenging. So we'll ask that question right after this break.
We're excited to announce that one of our most popular CPYU resources of all time has just been released in an updated and revised format. Tens of thousands of kids have been trained by their parents and youth workers to think Christianly about music and media with our How to Use Your Head to Guard Your Heart 3D Guide to Making Wise Media Choices. This easy-to-use teaching tool needs to be in your youth ministry toolbox if you desire to teach your students to integrate their faith into all of life. Jesus calls us to follow Him, and that includes following Him into the 6 to 9 hours a day of screen time that shape and mold the beliefs and behaviors of our kids. To learn more about our 3D Media Evaluation Guide and to order a copy for every member of your youth group, go to our website at cpyu.org. Teach your kids to engage with media to the glory of God. Well, welcome back, everybody, to Youth Culture Matters. We're having a conversation about the band U2 with a friend of ours who is actually connected with us right now from Belfast in Northern Ireland, Steve Stockman. Steve's written a book called Walk On, The Spiritual Journey of U2. There's actually a couple of editions of that out. We're going to talk more about the book in just a second. We've got Jason on with us as well from Spokane, and Mike Flavin is joining us from just outside of New York City. Wonderful New Providence, where he's a youth pastor there and a big-time U2 fan, and certainly a big part of what we do here at CPYU. Steve, during the break, I asked you about your show that you had on the BBC. Tell everybody about that. That is because you were on there for a while, and I remember I had a conversation with you.
Yeah.
Did an interview for that way, way back in the day. But tell us about that BBC show that you did. It's fascinating.
It was an incredible privilege. I was asked to come on. There was a program on a Sunday night on BBC Radio Ulster called The Gospel Show. And the person who was doing that got ill and went off for 6 months or 3 months, actually. And so they invited me in to do the show, and I really took it my own way and discovered after 3 months that I had it for longer, and I was on there for 10 years. And I have to say the BBC gave me complete freedom, and that we had to change the name from The Gospel Show to Rhythm and Soul, because we felt that what I did with the show, I was taking it away from just Christian music, and I was bringing in some of the secular music with theological ideas in them. So I would have had on that show, we would have played Switchfoot, we would have played Jars of Clay, And then alongside that, we'd have played Radiohead and Tom Waits and obviously copious amounts of U2, Rich Mullins, who I'm a big fan of, alongside Bruce Springsteen. And so it was wonderful. And what I would do is I would go into my study with all my CDs on a Sunday afternoon, and I would come up with a theme. Usually I would come up with a theme, and almost it was like sewing together a sermon with the 10 songs I was using and taking the listeners on a journey from the opening songs right through to the end. And I was amazed at how, because it was BBC Radio, listening in the car that wouldn't normally listen to anything Christian, and I was in conversations with people about music that I couldn't believe were listening to the show. So it was a wonderfully privileged time. It also gave me the opportunity to have, you know, we had Bill Maloney on the show and Sarah Mason on the show and Derek Webb and Sandra McCracken and Bebo Norman. Anybody that came to Belfast, I was able to put them on and interview them. And people like yourself, Walt, not only musicians, but if there was anybody interesting in town, I was able to just do what I wanted. So it was an incredibly privileged 10 years. And obviously lots of you too in the mix.
That's great. Well, and this actually fits really well. When we went to the break, you know, Walt was saying that asking someone what their favorite chapter or most challenging one was is sometimes some of the hardest questions to answer. So I apologize in advance. But just to segue off of what you had just said, there is something that you had written in your book that has always stood out. Because one of the things that we do with some of our staff is we have them read through this. A lot of them now don't really understand you too, but you had said, for those willing to take time to look, popular music is brimming with songs of spirituality, energized quests, some worth avoiding, but many worth engaging. And I absolutely love the dynamic of what you are doing through that show and what you did with this book. But coming back to that one question, if you're able, what were some of your funnest or most challenging chapters that you wrote when you were writing Walk On?
Initially, I go to the chapters from the updated version, not just because I want those of you who have the first edition to realize that there is a second edition and it's out there, because it's a long way from me getting royalties for that book. But I think that the last six chapters that I wrote for the update, first of all, can I say at that stage I knew what I was doing, because I had no idea when I wrote the first edition what I was doing. I think they're better crafted chapters. I think, and I think what I loved about those was that I wasn't just talking about the music. I was talking about Bono with his all the stuff about HIV and AIDS that he was working on and red campaigns and making poverty history. And so I think those chapters were very dear to my heart, because that's something I'm very much involved in my ministry. But if you go back to the early chapters, I think the biggest challenge was definitely Zeuropa. For me personally, because I don't think I had delved into that album the way I had done with other albums. And so the wonderful thing about that album is I come out really appreciating that album far more because I had to write a chapter on it. My wife, after we'd watched Million Dollar Hotel, I remember the credits were rolling and she said to me, "All the best with that chapter, love," because that was a difficult film to get into, I think. But I enjoyed that film and I enjoyed that chapter. But I suppose if I'm going back to chapters, Sunday Bloody Sunday is the first song they really became political about, and it's about my home city. And I think being able to express not only you two singing about your home city, but so being able to talk about you two and your home city at the same time is a wonderful privilege and a wonderful thing. I was at Calvin College a couple of years ago, and I showed a little bit of Slane Castle, where he does Sunday Bloody Sunday at Slane Castle. And at the end of the song, Bono walks back to the stage and names individually every one of the victims of the Omagh bomb. And so we're in this beautiful lecture theatre in Calvin College. I'm 4,000 miles away from home. And you two are on this wall. The entire wall is taken up with this video. And they're singing about Belfast. They're singing about the peace process that I'm fortunate enough now to be part of being involved in. And they name those names, and there was tears running down my face, not only because of the poignancy and the sadness of the song, but because my city was being given the dignity and the prayerfulness of this song in the middle of this concert. And so when it comes to you two, talking about you two in Ireland is for me the greatest buzz.
Gosh, that's so... I can't imagine what it would be like to, you know, Mike and I and Walt are big fans, but I can't imagine what it's like to be from your island, from Ireland, and to have witnessed, been a part of, and now write about it. And so that's just, what a privilege. What an incredible encounter.
Let me share a story, Jason. You're going to love this. And I haven't shared this publicly, but we're going to share this at the U2 conference is coming to Belfast, to Fitzroy here and Queen's University in June time. It's a conference they've had twice in the States. Scott Cahoon from Ohio has put these academic conferences together, and they're coming to Belfast. So I'm going to the first time this story will be told publicly will be an interview on that night. It's with one of the Rowan brothers, who is the one who was caught up in basically raised by wolves is about him, and so Raised by Wolves, Songs of Innocence, it's a song about a Dublin bombing, and the Rowan brothers are Bono's mates, and one of them was caught up in this bomb, and as a result of that became a drug addict because he was 11 years of age when he was in the bomb. He saw all kinds of things he shouldn't have seen, and as a result of that, he told me, he said, I went into school on the Monday and nobody gave me any counselling. I just had to deal with it. And so the way he dealt with it was going into addiction. And so before we did one of my Preach Jockey Nights songs of U2 being performed and me speaking in Dublin, he came up to tell me this story. And he told me that he had... he wanted to come out of addiction, so he went to Cleveland, Ohio, to a detox center. And he arrived in, and the guy picked him up and said, they're going to allow you tomorrow. Basically, this center, he was going to be there for 6 months, and he was going to not see anybody on the outside for 6 months. But the guy says to him, we're going to give you a day in Cleveland to see Cleveland. And he said to them, I don't want to see Cleveland. I want to go in here and get clean. But the guy said, look, they've given you a day. Let's go and see Cleveland. So they went around Cleveland and they ended up at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And when they went into the Hall of Fame, they went around and he said, I thought that was quite interesting. And then he said on his way out, he noticed that there was a U2 360 tour exhibition. So he said to the guy, do you mind if we go back and see this? And the guy said, no, go ahead. So he said, the way Andy says it, he says, oh, well, you know, Bobo's shorts were up there and the Edge's guitar was up there and it was all very interesting. And then he said, I walked across to a glass case table and I looked down into the table. And in the table under the glass were the original lyrics scribbled of Bad. And that song was about me. And he said, I looked down into this lyric and I felt God on my shoulder saying, look at those lyrics, Andy. Those lyrics were written about you. And I've never given up on you. I'm here. You're going to get through this. And so he said to the guy with him, he said, here, come here, come here, come here. He said, these lyrics are about me. And the guy, I think, said, you need to go into detox, sir, you know. So he comes out of 6 months of detox and he gets a phone call in Cleveland that is from U2 saying, come to the gig in Philadelphia, or was it Pittsburgh? You might have to YouTube this because it happens on the YouTube video that's of this gig. He gets a call to go and he asks the guy who took him around Cleveland if he wants to go with him. And they get to the gig and he gets a text saying, come back and see Bono. And the guy's with him just out of his mind at this stage. But he goes backstage and he says to Bono, You're not going to believe this. I looked into this glass case, and there were the words of Bad, and God was on my shoulder, Bono, saying, I haven't let you go. Look, I'm always with you. And Bono looked at him and said, where did they get those lyrics? I have no idea that those lyrics even exist. And Andy just says, Bono, it was God. So I had the privilege of meeting Bono when they did the Songs of Innocence tour here in Belfast, and we went backstage, and you're not sure what you say to your heroes. Nervously, Bono came towards me and shook my hand, and my friend who'd got me into that particular inner circle said, oh, Steve knows the Rowan brothers. And we started talking about Andy, and he said, Steve, he said, did he tell you that story about Pittsburgh? Yeah, he did. And he says, I really have no idea where he got those lyrics. And what fascinates me about the story is when Bono's mother died and he was 14 years of age, this family across the road in Cedarwood Road took Bono in and looked after him. And they took him to children's Bible clubs and they introduced him to God. That's all on the Songs of Innocence and sleeve notes. And what fascinates me is that 40 years later, almost, the guy that they saved by bringing into their home, those parents, Bono was the one who saved their son from addiction by writing a song that was found in a glass case somewhere in Cleveland. And now Johnny's going into all kinds of places in Dublin, sharing the gospel, sharing that testimony of a story where God was with him, because when he saw those lyrics, he knew that God was with him. And I just think two people loved their neighbour as themselves. And years later, it came back to bless the family of the couple that loved him. I preached it here in Fitzroy one morning to talk about loving your neighbour. And I just think it's amazing to see how God uses ordinary people, rock stars, lyrics, miracles, all that kind of stuff. Sorry to go off on that, but
no,
I think Jason,
no,
of anybody,
great.
No. Jason of anybody in the world probably wants to hear that.
I'm glad I just heard that. That's awesome. Those are the best stories. Yeah.
So Andy's coming up to the conference. Andy Rowan's coming up to the conference, and I'm going to interview him and bring that story out of him at the conference, which I hope will be streamed, and I hope we'll be able to be seen beyond here.
Yeah, if we can find a link on that, we'll include that on the podcast page.
Yeah,
Mike, did you have a question or?
Yeah, you know, Steve, one of my favorite memories was I was watching U2's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which it seemed to me they really didn't want to go there yet. And the Edge got up and he said this great line. He said, people watch Spinal Tap and laugh. He goes, I watch it and I cry, because that is, we are determined to never become kind of a parody of ourselves, you know? And I guess I was wondering, like, what has kept them fresh all these years? And, you know, the implications of that are for us all. I mean, I've been doing pretty much the same thing for 40 years with high school students. And what's been the key for them to stay fresh?
I was asked that on Sky News one night when they won the Oscars for I think How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. They asked me to come on to Sky News. And what happens when you're on a studio, it's a bit like this, actually. You're looking into, it's different than this. I'm looking into a camera and I don't know, I've got headphones on. And I can't see the interviewers. We're on Sky News at 6 o'clock, and I don't know what question he's going to ask. Now, he sees Reverend Steve Stockman on his camera or whatever, and he says, Steve, sex and drugs and rock and roll, how have you two stayed so fresh for all these years? And I answered, I think it's to do with the sex and drugs. They had no interest in that, so they put all their concentration into the rock and roll. And I am convinced that the only reason they're still fresh is that it is a vocational thing to bring God's word onto stages across the world. And it's a missional thing. For them, that's what they do. And therefore, if you have God's word to do that and you have this journey of faith to do that, you have more than five albums in you, because there's a whole big book there of all kinds of things that you can deal with, Whereas most of our other genius artists have probably a career of five to, I mean, even my favorites like Joni Mitchell or Neil Young, yeah, they're still making albums. But the truth of the matter is that Songs of Experience, and I know this divides you two fans, as a pop album, your 16th album, and you're in your 50s, this is an astoundingly and astonishing achievement that you would be as fresh and as keen and as eager and hungry as you are. And I think it's the faith that drives them that makes the difference between you two and all the other bands. They weren't interested in just getting a swimming pool in Malibu. They were interested in changing the world.
Mm. So it's having the right view of the cosmos. It's having a clear sense of calling, and like a good preacher, never runs out of, you know, stuff to preach. I mean, you just, over time, your passion grows, right?
And that's, if you're prepared to every week bring what's happening in the world and the Word of God together, then you never run out of ideas, because those two things, when they caress and collide, as I keep talking about, they are full of energy. And if you're a rock band and you're asking questions about the cosmos, then my goodness, you have a few questions to ask. But then if you find the God who created the cosmos, you have a few answers to give as well. Yeah. So does it any better than that?
That's awesome. Great question, Mike. I love that. And thanks for your answer, awesome. Steve. I think, and boy, you were sharp there in that moment with a guy from Sky, right? I mean, that had to be one of those moments that after you said it, you went, man, where did that come from?
Oh, I was pleased. I was high-fiving nobody, but I was high-fiving anyway.
Yeah. I've had a couple of those over the course of over 60 years, and you just wish that it was recorded or, you know, that's great. I love that. That's awesome.
I'm looking forward to the second one. Yeah.
Well, it might come after the break, so that's a good segue. So we're going to take a break here. We're talking to Steve Stockman. Steve's joining us from Belfast, Northern Ireland. He's the author of the book Walk On, The Spiritual Journey of U2, and he's also a field musicologist. He's a pastor, and he's a preach jockey. I love this. This is great. You've really given us good stuff to – we're going to be thinking about this and talking about this for a while, so – stick with us. We'll be right back with Steve after the break. I'm very excited to tell you about a new resource we've just launched here at CPYU. Just Add Parents is a series of ready-to-use parent meetings that feature 3 10-minute video teaching segments, each followed by a time for guided small group discussion. Youth workers, Just Add Parents is perfect for use in your parent meeting or a parent class. The teaching content is not only designed to inform parents regarding pressing cultural issues, but to equip them to respond to these unfolding realities in a gospel-centered, practical manner, all with the goal of helping you help parents lead their children into believing and behaving Christianly in today's rapidly changing culture. Each Just Add Parents Parents Meeting includes video teaching segments, PDFs of discussion questions, and other handouts. You can order Just Add Parents as either a download or on a thumb drive. I'm happy to announce that the first installment in the Just Add Parents Parent Meeting series is now available, and it's titled Tech-Sensible Parenting. If you want to help your parents understand and respond proactively to kids and technology with a Just Add Parents Parent Meeting, you can learn more on our website at cpyu.org. Welcome back to Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller with Jason Sochenik, Mike Flavin, and our buddy Steve Stockman, who's joining us from Belfast, Northern Ireland, talking about U2, and Steve's been tracking with them for years and has written a book called Walk On. We'll actually include a link to that so you can find out where to get the book, and once you get the book, read the book. It's a great book that the three of us here have read, and the other one wrote it, so it's something we want you to check in on and check out for yourself. So, Steve, we do a thing called Take Five. This is just a fun little interlude where people can get to know you. And I did ask you during the break if you're game for it. You said you'd let me know after you answered the questions. So here we go. All right, so real quick, just off the top of your head. So this first question, I'm assuming – that you do, you know, like to listen to stuff on vinyl. At least I'll use, you know, a reference to vinyl music. But if you had the opportunity, like if you today, like once you're done with us here, you're able to go and drop the needle on one artist's album, what would you be listening to today? Who is it? Who would you drop the needle on?
Always Over the Rhine from Ohio. It would be their album called Ohio. Oh. And it's a double album. I just got it on vinyl recently. It's just beautiful.
Great.
Over the Rhine.
Okay, Over the Rhine. All right. I know you're a reader because you're a writer. What's the best book you've read over the course of the last year? Give us a good recommendation.
Oh, my goodness. I read a lot of rock biographies, but I think the best book I've read recently is a book, and I'm not even going to be able to tell you her name because she's Ugandan. We spend a lot of time in Uganda. I'm doing 6 weeks there in the summer, and it's a book called Kintu, and it's about it takes you through the history of Uganda right up to date and very personal stories. I found it very, very gripping. I think the best rock biography might have been Robbie Robertson's rock biography. I thought it was very well written and crafted. Elvis Costello's, I read not so long ago, was very good. And I've just started today a new book called Trouble Songs by Stuart Bailey. Stuart Bailey, to link it with U2, wrote the sleeve notes of the Slane Castle video. He's a Belfast journalist. And he's just written a book about the songs and the Northern Ireland Troubles, and it's a fascinating book, and I cannot wait to get heavier into that one.
Mm. All right, you mentioned Northern Ireland. The three of us, Jason, Mike, and myself, we'll add Chris, four of us, come to Belfast. What's the one thing you're going to take us to see first?
Every time somebody, because Americans come all the time and they say, where are you going to take us? And I never knew. I suppose the biggest thing at the moment is our Titanic Museum.
Okay.
And, no, I tell you where I'm taking you today, though. I'm taking you to our other museum, the Ulster Museum, because at the moment in the Ulster Museum, just this week, they have put back up an exhibition in our art gallery, our national gallery, of a painter called Colin Davidson. And he did 18 portraits of people who'd lost loved ones during our troubles. And it's the most amazing exhibition that I've ever seen. And if you were in Belfast right now, I would take you over to that museum to see Colin Davidson's Silent Witness exhibition.
Mm. All right. So now let's switch it here. You come to the United States and you want us to take you out to dinner. What's your favorite American food?
I'm Irish. As long as there's potatoes on the table, I'm going to be all right. As soon as there's a shortage of potatoes, I'm on the next boat out of here. So I don't mean fries, or I don't mean I need just good mashed potatoes.
Okay.
And you can put anything in that, but probably a good steak in America. You're always getting good steak. You're good at your food. Anywhere. You could take me anywhere, and I would love it.
All right, good. All right, last question. When was the last time you were at a hurling match?
Oh, dear. I love hurling. I think a couple of years ago, my children, we were watching soccer on a Sunday afternoon, as I do every week, and it was the All-Ireland hurling final. It was maybe three seasons ago, and it was probably, we got fortunate, it was probably the best hurling match that was ever played, and it was just 70 minutes of utter sporting excitement. And we turned over to the soccer after it, and it was so dull. Hurling is a sport that doesn't come from my community, but if there was one game that I could play that I wasn't allowed to play because I was a Protestant, it would be hurling. I think it's the most incredible game in the world. It's ice hockey in the air, for goodness sake.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. We might need to, well, actually, Chris and I will probably decide afterwards. We're going to replace Jason with you as a co-host, because we have arguments all the time about soccer, and is soccer exciting? And Jason is pro soccer. Yeah, I know. I mean, it's a good sport, but
Say that again. That's the first time Walt's ever said that, by the way.
I said it's a good sport compared to sitting around and doing nothing. But I had to clarify it there because you'll use that soundbite. I know you will. But Jason, do you know what hurling is? Have you ever watched hurling?
I have no idea what hurling is.
I know you're thinking it's like youth workers are sitting here going, why are they talking about throwing up, like a throwing up match or something like that? But, Mike, do you know what it is?
No, what is it?
Oh, come on. Chris, do you ever watch hurling? It is awesome. Well, it's kind of like
it's ice hockey in the air.
Yeah, there's something about it that's, for me, I'd say it's like lacrosse and baseball.
So you
got to watch it. It's an amazing sport.
Very fast. This is the problem
when, you know, with all these TV networks we have now, nobody puts hurling on. But we used to be able to watch it a couple of times a year here in the U.S. when I was growing up on ABC's Wide World of Sports. And whenever it was on, I had to watch it. It was awesome. So go ahead and Google hurling videos, and we'll see what comes up. But Irish hurling, that's what you want to
see. I think you can get it on PlayStation, so you might be able to play it even.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's one I've never heard of. So they have that on, like, Xbox and PlayStation. That's great. Yeah. Jason, it'll cure you of your soccer obsession.
Are you Sounders fan? Seattle Sounders, Jason?
Oh, Sounders, yeah. You're very good. Yeah. I'm much more Liverpool than I am Sounders.
Oh, Jason, we don't need to be meeting today, my friend. You have broken my heart over the last week.
I figured I might. No. I'm sorry.
Oh, my word. I'm in spiritual crisis, and you're sitting there with your proud, arrogant.
All right, I think our audience is falling asleep.
Yeah, we're too much soccer. We need to move on.
Too much soccer. Let's get back to you, too.
Yeah. All right, Jason, go ahead. We've got a couple of questions we want to ask Steve before we have to let him go. So,
yeah. Well, one of the things that's not in your book, one of the two albums that you've brought up a couple times, A Song of Innocence and Songs of Experience. I just wanted to get your take on some of those. You've talked a little bit. You talked about Raised by Wolves. But I'm just curious if you have other thoughts around those two albums. Because you had said earlier, and I think this is true, as I've talked to a lot of other U2 fans, that it's divided fans. It's fans haven't necessarily understood all of it. So I would love to hear your take on those two albums.
I like the albums. I guess, you know, one of the things for me that's interesting is if you ask me how I get into a U2 album, I don't mean this the way I'm going to say it, but it doesn't really matter how it sounds to me. I'm looking at the theology. I'm looking at the insights. I'm looking at the cultural comment, the social observation. But I thought Songs of Innocence was a good album, but I think Songs of Experience is an unbelievable album. It may not have been the one that if Bono and the Edge had come and asked me what they should do, that I would have told them to do, because it's very, there's a lot of pop stuff going on there, but I switched it on and I just couldn't get it out of my car stereo for weeks. It was just so incessantly melodic and powerful. And so I think these two albums are great. However, we have seen how Songs of Innocence has played out on a stage. And I don't think you can ever understand a U2 album until you see the live gig. And they're in Montreal at the moment rehearsing for the start of the tour in May. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see what they do with the Songs of Experience in the live setting. But I think as albums, they're very strong. I think there's a lot of great theology in them. There's a lot of great social comment. And I think Bono is being maybe more personal in this album than he's been ever before. And there's just some great anthems. And the interesting thing, when my children were growing up, they weren't getting U2 because it wasn't immediately melodic. They were getting the Beatles immediately. But this new album has my 17-year-old listening to a U2 album. Now, whatever the fans that are my age think about that and whether they want that to happen or not, that's a phenomenal ability for a band of their age to become relevant to my 17-year-old daughter. And nobody should knock how difficult that is today and how successful they've been at doing it.
Powerful.
Yeah. Hey, Steve, you use a word a lot in your book that I love a lot. And it's the word art and artist, you know, and I underlined a million times where you wrote, Jesus was much more of an artist than a preacher. Can you talk a little bit more about, I think so much a life, certainly ministry. It's an art. You know, what's the key to becoming a great artist in your craft?
I think as a preacher, I'm an artist. Daniel Lanois, who's obviously produced a lot of U2 albums, in his biography, Soul Mining, he discusses or talks about how a song coming together or an album coming together is like all of these splinters swirling around a pole, and then suddenly, magnetically, they come together to make this piece of art. And that describes perfectly my week in a sermon. It's reading the passage. It's letting incredible amounts of stuff swirl around in my heart and soul and mind. It's going back to the scriptures, asking what's going on in my congregation that week, what's going on in the world that week. And then on a Sunday morning, I have these 20 to 25 minutes to put together a sermon that has to be. I think it was Marshall McLuhan that said, anyone who thinks there's a difference between education and entertainment doesn't know the first thing about either. And if I want to educate my congregation, I have to be artistically sharp enough to grab their imaginations first thing in that sermon and to take them on an experience that's not just oral. I want to touch the grow. There's an Irish word called grow, which means love, but it's an automatic appear, kind of the heart grow, that thing that stirs you in your life. And to me, that my sermon has to be able to do that the way you too gig has to do it. Now, I'm no Bono and I'm no Bruce Springsteen, but to me, that's a piece of art. And if you look at the Bible, the prophets are poets. They're dramatists. And we've got systematic theologians trying to unpack what is literature. And I'm sorry, but that doesn't work. We've got to re-engage with the scriptures with the way the scriptures are, and we've got to see that Jesus was more a storyteller than he was ever a sermon teller. And we've got to realize that God was using art not because it was a resource available to him, but because it's intrinsic in the way that God communicates with the world, that he creates, that he's artistic. And if we're not being artistic in our pastoral care and our worship and our preaching and our mission and our relationships, I don't think we're on the same page.
Yeah, and you also speak to the fact that here's the quote. Let me just read it to you. You wrote, maybe postmodernism was a better canvas to throw out the truth of God's grace interaction with men. What is it about postmodernism that, I mean, if I read the way I read that, you're suggesting that it's more conducive to art than maybe a modernity?
Yeah, it's an interesting, I may have meant that at the time. I may have tempered that slightly, but I get a little bit frustrated when I hear people dismissing postmodernity and taking modernity hook, line, and sinker, because both of them are faulty worldviews that the scriptures have to transcend. And therefore, I think that it may have been that postmodernity in some ways could have been and has been used in good ways in order for us to get back to the narrative, to get back to the art, to get back to the mystery of God. But I'm not saying that that means everything about postmodernity is good. Neither am I saying that everything about modernity was good, because in many ways that made theology very scientific and very rigid and very structured. So the scriptures is where we have to get back to understand that transcends it. So I'm living in a postmodern relational world, and I read John 1 and I see the word becoming flesh and dwelling among us, and I'm going, God, you trump carded the postmodernists, because you were doing the relational thing long before it became an idea. It's right there. And so what we've got to do is make sure that none of these worldviews that we have are worshipped or seen as the best worldview. But I think all of them can give us a new insight into the scriptures, a new insight into God, to be a new resource to see that. But we've always got to be careful about the dodgy stuff too. So every time in every period of history, the Reformation was a wonderfully fertile time of finding a lot of stuff, but there was a lot of bad stuff in there. And so we've got to constantly be critiquing what is good about the era we're living in, the spirit of the age that mixes with the gospel and the scriptures. pictures, and we've got to be always asking, where are the dangers, where are the weak points, what have we to be careful with? And in 20, 30 years, somebody's going to look back in my ministry and say, he was really good at that, but he was really weak at that. That's going to be all right, because I'm not infallible. That's who I am.
Here's what I love about all this, just, you know, to bring this to a close, because I know we've got to bring it to an end here, but just a thoughtfulness through which, I mean, the intentional thoughtfulness and the way that you're thinking about these things, Steve, and what you said in the beginning, just about word and world together, you know, it reminds me always when I hear that of John Stott, you know, who talked about dual listening, you know, knowing both word and world. And you've done that effectively, and you've done that in so many ways, certainly in this book, Walk On. But love tracking with you. Here's an ignorant question. Are you writing and posting things anywhere right now? Are you blogging at all, Steve? Can we point people to that?
If you press Steve Stockman into Google, you will either get that Republican senator from Texas or me. And very quickly, you'll work out which one is which. But my blog is Soul Surmise. And basically, when I came to Fitzroy, I realized, coming into a parish situation out of chaplaincy, I wasn't going to have the time to sit down and write 40, 50,000 words in a book.
Yeah.
But I could blog every day. And so I try my best to blog 300-400 words every day. That could be a review of an album. I've done most of the songs from – I did all of the songs, I think, from songs of – not all of them. I've done most of the songs of the last two albums. I do lots of stuff about peacemaking. I do some scripture stuff, some poems, some liturgies. And so I do that as much as I can. However, this year I've taken on a project where I'm ghostwriting a guy in Northern Ireland who set up a charity called Fields of Life, and I'm going to help him write his memoir. So I'm going back to the writing a little bit for that, and who knows, there might be another book in me if I can find one that hasn't been written.
Yeah. I hear you with that. That's a big undertaking, and you know that it sounded, you know, very inspired and almost magical when you described writing Walk On. You know, to have a week and write 45,000 words, that's a dream. That's awesome. It's a good dream. That's super, yeah. So, well, listen, I want to let everybody know who's tuned into us here and who's streaming this right now, the podcast, that anything that we've mentioned here in terms of books, any of the resources Steve's mentioned, certainly his book Walk On, if you go to the homepage at cpyu.org, and click on the Youth Culture Matters podcast, you'll see a page that's got all of our podcasts archived. And if you go to this specific podcast with Steve Stockman, you'll see beneath the player, we'll include links to everything that's been mentioned today and even more. So that's a great resource. It's a way that we can serve you. We hope you tap into that. Mike Flavin, thanks for joining us. Jason, as always.
Hey, thanks. This is great.
Yeah, and Steve, what a pleasure it's been to connect with you again, and I'll let you know when potatoes are in season here, and we'll get you over here. and then we'll come over for a hurling match. We got to expose these guys to a good sport, huh?
I do feel this conversation has just started. That's my thing.
Yeah,
I think we've just begun.
Yeah, well, we'll get you on again, and certainly let us know if there's anything that you know is burning in your heart, and you're going, hey, I want to talk about this on the podcast. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun doing it. So thanks so much. Well, thanks everybody for joining us, and we will see you again next time on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.